Welcome back, everyone. We're now in the final session with dinner tonight. So the objective here is to talk about public policy. We've, on council, sort of had a real focus this year, and we've set up what we've called a public policy committee. So it's another committee, but the idea is to really ramp up the way we look at public policy. And it was interesting looking at the way we, certainly the way Simon Longstaff talked this morning about the role of professions. We certainly see that the actuarial role is to operate in the public interest. So this session really is to discuss some of the issues there. Firstly, I'd like to recognise PwC as the sponsor for this this function, so thank you to PwC. Now, I'm chair of the Public Policy Committee, and my role here is to have a debate with a number of people. I'll introduce those people first. And to save clapping every time they get up and sit down, we'll give them one clap at the start and one clap at the end. So, not yet, though. Wait for it. Wait for it. Not spontaneous clap. If they're worth a clap, then we'll give them one at the end. So, and there's Yolanda Beattie. Yolanda's the general manager of Honor Media. Honor Media are the company that the Institute use for our public policy strategy and media relations. So, for example, we saw John Trowbridge, when he went outside, he was surrounded by media. Not when I go outside, nobody wants to know me. He is surrounded by media and has TV interviews and that sort of stuff, and that's what Yolanda and her team do for us. Next to Yolanda is Peter Broadhead. Peter Broadhead's the first Assistant Secretary of the Health Reform Transition Office in the Department of Health. So Peter he sits inside government, he implements policy, he forms policy, and therefore has got a view about what he sees happening and how public debate influences the politics. Next to Peter is Melinda Howes. You'll know Melinda. She's our CEO, and she'll be talking about issues around how we set policy. That's Melinda. Andrew Bowell. Andrew Bowell is chair of the SEBPC, which, for those of you who don't know what that means, is the Superannuation and, what is it, Employee Benefit Practice Committee. We are thinking of changing the name of that one. that's the group that's set a lot of our superannuation policy, retirement incomes policy. Andrew's also the Managing Director of Towers Watson. I do apologise. Apparently, when I did my intro speech, which I thought was so fantastic yesterday, I actually mentioned the name of a former organisation, so it's Towers Watson he's from. Peter McCarthy. Peter's the chair of the GIPC, which is the General Insurance Practice Committee, and he's been obviously helping with policies on floods and those issues, natural disasters, and we'll talk to him about that. He's partner of Ernst & Young. And last one, but no means least, Kent Griffin, who's the chair of the Risk Management Practice Committee, and he's also a partner of Ernst & Young. We'll get to talking about some of the risk management issues and their policies and strategy in their area. So they're the key people. So would you like to welcome them? Thank you. So the way it's going to work is is the first three will get up here and speak for 5 or 10 minutes. I'll ask them a question. They'll speak on a topic. It's usually a topic related to this field of expertise. And so they'll sort of have their 5 or 10 minutes each. And then once they've each spoken, we'll then have a general discussion. You can send SMSs up. I'll take questions there. I've got a group of prepared questions. I want it to be controversial. I want to push the boundary a bit. But if we're all finished in 20 minutes, then we can all go out and have a drink. No pressure. Okay, so I'd first like to hand over to Yolanda Beattie. And the question for Yolanda really is, why do we even bother in public policy? Do actuaries want to read about other actuaries in the public? Does anybody really care? Why do we do it? So I'll hand over to Yolanda. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. I think there are two parts of this question. One is why bother influencing or seeking to influence public policy, and the other is why bother engaging the media as part of that pursuit. And I think my first point there is that actuaries have a really important and valuable contribution to make in many public policy areas. And that's not particularly well known. You know, I often have people ask me, who are your clients? And I almost always, out of the, you know, growing list of clients that I mention, I almost always mention the Institute of Actuaries. And I'm almost always greeted when I mention that with a bit of a, oh, that must be interesting. At which point I always leap to your defence and say, actually, actuaries are very interesting people and are definitely one of our most interesting clients because you have really important things to say about really important issues. And as a public affairs, public relations practitioner, that's what we live off. You know, we live off people who have got interesting ideas, and then we help you craft and shape those ideas, and then we help you sell those ideas to the press so you can get those thoughts and initiatives out to the public domain. So, you know, and if you look at the topics that you are engaging on, and just the members of this panel here are a good example, you know, retirement incomes and the future of the country's superannuation system has significance to every single member of the country, every single Australian. You know, managing the financial costs of natural disasters. Well, we've just seen a summer, you know, of incredible and horrific disasters, and the contribution that you have to play in helping formulate appropriate public policy and formulating the guidelines for appropriate public policy as the country tries to look forward and how we better manage those risks. You know, these are really important issues, and the profession has a really important role to play in the thinking that goes on behind the scenes. So, if that helps explain why it's important to be in the debate, why it's important to actually engage the press is goes to that awareness point. You know, if you want, it's one thing to kind of have an idea, but if nobody knows about it, then, you know, what's the point of having the idea? You know, and part of the role of the media is to help share ideas and get people thinking. And you look at where most of the coverage that we get for you guys is predominantly in the major business broadsheet, being the Fin Review, and occasionally a little bit in The Australian, but the bulk of our mainstream coverage is in that publication, which is really where thought leaders are reading. And so we're looking to get your views read by other thought leaders to make sure that the profession is understood as making an important contribution. Which kind of goes to my next point, and that's about maintaining and enhancing the status of the profession. And I think, you know, you guys have a somewhat unique reputation as being almost held at a level above so many others in terms of the effort that you go through to get your qualifications in the first place and then maintain them. You know, the incredibly arduous, you know, process to be called an actuary, you know, stands above, you know, many others and is in lines with, you know, heart surgeons. So part of our role is making sure that the status of the profession is maintained at that level, and so the way that you're contributing to the debate reflects that status, and that more people understand the importance of that status. And the work that we did during the GFC was a classic example of that, where trying to bring actuarial thinking to the need to strengthen financial systems and the role of enterprise risk management in strengthening financial systems and companies, indeed, is a good example of making sure that the status of the profession is known in those areas. And at the same time, achieving recognition for the significant input that you do make to important public policy decisions. And longevity risk has been a good example of that, where, you know, we're increasingly and often getting recognition in the press for the important role that the Institute in particular has in advancing the debate about how we need to address longevity risk in our retirement system. And then finally, I'd say the occasional role that engaging in public debate and engaging in the media is about defending actuarial positions. So thankfully, we haven't had to deal with this issue really at all in the couple of years that we've been working with the Institute. But there, you know, there are time to time when the profession comes into question and the decisions that actuaries make come into question that can have broader implications for that, you know, that important status that you do have in the public domain. And so, you know, if necessary and where appropriate, making sure that you're strategically engaging the media to appropriately defend that position is something that we also think about. So you have an important contribution to make. Not enough people know about that. And so our job is to continually make sure that we help you craft those ideas and shape those ideas and engage the media appropriately to have more people know just that contribution.
Thanks, Yolanda. Now Peter Broadhead sits inside government. He implements policy. He helps form policy. He sees politicians and how they work. And he sees actuaries and how we work and everybody else. So I'll ask Peter just to talk a bit about what he sees, not necessarily our role, but any role. How does government set policy? What are the levers that drive them? So I'll hand over to you, Peter. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Barry. Firstly, I should clarify I'm here as Peter Broadhead rather than representing the government or the department for whom I work. And I've worked for 20-odd years in particularly health policy. So what I bring to this discussion is my observations from that career. And out of that, I think the problem I've wrestled with all through that is what is policy and how is it formed? And particularly the tension between policy as a political thing and policy as a technical thing. And I think that, in a sense, is the tension about which this panel is speaking. Because, in a sense, actuaries are technical people. You have a particular technical expertise. I value it highly myself. I've used it in a number of instances in the work that I've done in the last 20-odd years. But it is a particular way of understanding, particularly pricing risk, and applying quantitative methods to problems. On the other hand, my experience over my years in policy has been that policy is a matter of opportunity. And so, notwithstanding the merits of the technical argument, the thing you most need is actually a political opportunity for policy to be formed. And I'll use a couple of examples to illustrate. Firstly, I'll use our universal health system, Medicare. If you look very briefly back at the history of that, there were a couple of technical fellows working in Melbourne many, many years ago, John Deeble and Richard Scotton, who were approached by the then Leader of the Opposition. In fact, I think he'd just been the Leader of the Opposition, Gough Whitlam, to come up with a health scheme. And they didn't actually get right to work on it because they thought it was a bit of a long shot, but eventually they got around to it and they designed something, which, and later on, sometime later, I understand, they presented it to him. Now, he went to them in about 1969, and, of course, Medibank, as it eventuated, was through an Act of Parliament in 74. In fact, it was 74. And to give you some idea of the political opportunity, we only got Medibank at the time because there was a double dissolution of Parliament after supply was stopped by the upper house, and Whitlam managed to get the bill for Medibank, or the Health Insurance Act, introduced and rejected a second time so it could be included in the bills that were then subject to a joint sitting of House after Parliament was reconvened if they were successful. In the end, it passed by one vote at a joint sitting of Parliament. So you had something that was crafted in a technical sense by a couple of experts down in Melbourne. Some years later, 5 years later, it scraped through on a joint sitting of Parliament and it became the system that was introduced as Medibank up and operational in 1975. It still forms the bones of what we have. We won't go into the history of ups and downs after that. But it's an example where you had technical work but political opportunity. The other one I'll use is the one I'm involved with now, which is the current push for national health reform. The then Leader of the Opposition, there's a bit of a theme emerging here, the then Leader of the Opposition, Kevin Rudd, decided that the public were ripe for a undertaking to fix what the public didn't like, which was the constant bickering between the Commonwealth and the states about who was doing what with public hospitals and who was funding them and whether it was enough and how long you had to wait for things like emergency departments and elective surgery and so on. So this was a political opportunity. He saw it as a political opportunity. I'm not going to pass any judgments on whether he was right and wrong. He was the politician. And this became an undertaking, and it became an undertaking that was taken to an election where they were successful in 2007 in being elected, and then they formed a commission to look at how this might be done. As it happens, I worked as the head of policy and strategy for that commission. And out of it, we have a set of reforms which are now in the roller coaster ride of federal relations in this country as to what we may or may not get up and how it might look. It's still something that's most recently been revisited at COAG on February the 13th. We're in the process at the moment of attempting to reach a final agreement based on heads of agreement reached at COAG on how the reforms will operate nationally. So once again, you had a foment of work in the Commission. They came up with 123 separate recommendations over a period of more than a year, with lots of public consultation, but also some technical work. And without naming names, in some parts of this, there were actuaries involved in the work of the National Health and Hospitals Reform Commission. Not in all parts, but in some parts. So good technical work, but combined with political opportunity. So if you're trying to influence public policy, and you know, I am in part, I suppose, paid to have a role in that, to the extent the government wants to listen to anything I say, and you have a range of arrangements where you're trying from time to time to influence aspects of public policy, one of the things that you have to be aware of is opportunity. What are the opportunities? What are the opportunities that are likely to present, and how do you marry that opportunity with technical work? Bad policy, in my view, often is the thing that's, you know, it's sort of a knee-jerk political reaction. Very little technical work involved. Just slap it on and hope you get away with it sort of thing at the worst. And again, I'm not going to use any examples. Good policy, on the other hand, can be a very good synthesis of political opportunity. In other words, somebody who at the political or government level is deft in political handling, understands where stakeholders are coming from, understands how to navigate the shoals of politics in order to get something through, exercises leadership at its best, but combined, because politicians do what politicians do, they're not usually technical experts, but combined with a very high quality of analysis and input on the technical side. It's not always like that, I'm afraid to say, but at its best, that's what it is like. And so it's that marriage of technically excellent work with political opportunity and knowing when those opportunities present and how to buy into it when it happens. There are probably a variety of channels you can do this. Some of them are quite challenging. At the top, you can always try and influence the politicians themselves. I don't actually know the history of how the disability scheme that was developed while Bill Shorten was disability minister eventuated, and there'll be maybe others here who do. But at that level, I suspect that the minister himself was involved quite directly and immediately in some of the discussions about what this was and how it was going to work or not. So there is coming in at the level of the government or the politicians themselves. Other than that, you can try and influence some of the hardest people to influence, which is probably the bureaucracy, such as me, only because they tend to be terribly distracted by what they're trying to do and how they're trying to work. That's a faint apology, I'm afraid, for the way some of us behave. But again, you can try and get involved in the game at that level. And again, you know, in my experience, good departments, good bureaucrats will source technical expertise that is relevant to the things that they're being asked to do by government, and will find ways to feed it in and improve policy through doing so. Other times it doesn't work so well. And again, I'm not going to offer examples of that, or I'll be beaten to death by my colleagues. And lastly, there is the route via the public, which is an entirely valid route for a group such as yourselves, but quite a difficult one. You know, the media these days has a short attention span. So, you know, ways of presenting things that leaven the debate in a technical sense are quite difficult to get across. And again, I'll take no sides, but the example of scientists trying to get science across in the current climate debate is an interesting challenge. I'll let you form your own view about to what degree you think that the public representation of the sides of that debate reflects the underlying technical work and understandings of the general scientific community. So it can be, it's an entirely valid way to proceed. It's sometimes a difficult way to proceed, to go through the public channel. But one you shouldn't, you know, leave aside if there's a way of bringing information out that the public might take an interest in. Coming back to my own thing, I thought I should at least mention that in what we're doing in a more narrow sense, in a more particular sense, one of the things that the reform's doing is trying to reinvent the way hospitals will be funded as between the Commonwealth and the states in this country. This is a long and vexed problem. You know, the former Leader of the Opposition and former Prime Minister, I think, did understand that the public were a little over all of the ways in which this debate tends to happen, and that there was an opportunity there. But in the process, what we're moving towards is a data-driven system. So in other words, we're moving away from the sling the money over the fence and you know, argue for 5 years whether it was enough, to an approach which basically tries to measure the output of hospitals and provide funds accordingly. This is not new. It was originally done in the late 70s, early 80s in New Jersey, I think, were the first lot to do it under the modern mode. When Jeff Kennett was Premier in Victoria, they introduced it as case mix funding in the Victorian about 18 years ago. But again, it will be slightly differently done for reasons of being done at the national and as between Commonwealth and states. But it means that we're going to start getting our hands dirty on a whole lot of data about what hospitals do, how they do it, what it costs to do it, and so on. It involves things to do with understanding risk, because this will be used to fund not states but hospitals at the level of local hospital networks. So there's a whole issue about what the revenue stream is, how it's determined, how this plays for the recipients in terms of financial risk and so on, and the relationship between their activity and the revenue that they generate. This is new territory for many public hospitals in this country. It's old territory in a sense for private hospitals, but it's an interesting set of developments. And the other side where I'd say there's a role, and I think in amongst all of that, I'd be surprised if there isn't some work for actuaries and people with a very thorough understanding of quantitative methods and the pricing of risk and so on. And on the other side, there is an attempt to measure performance and publish it. So we're sort of taking a My Schools approach, but now it's going to be a My Hospitals approach. Any of you go and visit, there is a My Hospitals website, that you'll find that it's got information that is not terribly current. It's all we have, but it's not terribly current, and it's reporting, you know, the things that historically have been reported at jurisdictional level. So it's looking at waiting times and so on. There's a move on to set up through legislation a National Health Performance Authority, which is going to report a larger range of indicators at the hospital level, including public and private hospitals and primary care. Now, one of the things that is going to come up in that debate is risk adjustment. If you're going to try and measure how well people do, you have to adjust for the circumstances in which they work. And since this is going to be quantitative information, we come back to quantitative adjustment for risk. Now, I would suggest that there's room for some actuaries involved in that work. I don't think it's going to be tomorrow because we're not there yet. But it's an example which I thought I'd try and give out of the work that I'm currently doing, where there are going to be opportunities, in my view, for people with your skills to be involved and to influence what happens.
Thanks, Peter. The next speaker is Melinda. So Melinda is going to talk a bit about what's the logistics of how we currently set public policy. So it's sort of the resources, how committees work and that sort of thing. So rather than talking about public policy, she'll talk about the logistics of it. And then once she's done that, we'll then get into actual public policy issues. Thank you, Melinda.
Thanks, Barry. Hi, everyone. So how does the Institute actually undertake public policy? Well, the first thing is, and those of you who've seen our org chart outside on the stand might not believe this, but we actually have very scarce resources in the Secretariat. I had a number of people come up to me at drinks last night after I brought all the staff up here across the stage and said, what are all those people doing in there? Why have you got so many staff? You'll see from our org chart we've got about 24, 25 names on there. A lot of those people are part-timers. We're an employer of choice. We offer very flexible working arrangements. So I've got lots of yummy mummies and yummy daddies working for me. So we've got about 20 full-time equivalent, 20 headcount. What do we do with those 20 people? Well, we run 100 events a year with our three event staff. We have 6 of our staff involved in education. We administer education for over 1,000 students through Parts 1, 2 and 3. That involves both coordinating with unis and with the UK and the Part 3 that we pretty much run ourselves. We provide membership services to 3,700 members. We work with our members to write professional standards and professional guidance. A lot of those are actually written by my staff. We run a research grants program. We coordinate the activities of our 650 actively involved volunteers. So we've got massive logistical challenges there. And importantly, we represent the profession in liaison with government and with regulators and on a public policy effort. So I had the opportunity over the last few days to talk to some of my counterparts in other countries, and I was asking them about the size of their membership and the size of their staff. And in South Africa, and I'm pleased to report that ours seems to be quite in proportion with overseas organisations. For example, we are double the size of South Africa in terms of number of members, and we're also double the size in terms of staff. And the society in the US, I think we've got around a fifth the number of members and around the fifth the number of staff as well. So I'm pretty comfortable we've got our resourcing levels right. Okay, so what, given that public policy is a key thing that we do, how many staff do we have in that? Well, when I was Director of Public Policy at ASFA, the Superfunds Association, I had seven people working for me, so there were eight full-time staff. At the Institute, when I joined, admittedly there'd been no CEO for 7 months, but we had zero staff working on public policy. So I'm spending a bit of my time working on it, and we now have, so the logistics of how we do this now, obviously we've got a lot of work being done by our volunteers, but we have two consultants now working both part-time for us, Rebecca Johnstone and Rick Shaw. I can see Rick's hairdo over there, so I can see that you're here. Rick, do you want to stand up? And Rebecca's up the back there. Do you want to stand up as well? So these are our two public policy consultants who help us out. Thanks, guys. Okay, so how do we do it? Well, I've put some examples here of recent things that this is just the last five submissions we've made, basically. So what we've done, the way we've always done public policy, is, to be honest, fairly reactive. As Peter just mentioned, we're a technical community and we've always been very strong contributors to matters technical. And what we do is Julia Purvis, our office manager, monitors the Capital Monitor Service, which gives us a heads up on anything that's coming out of government for consultation or out of regulators. So we know something's come out, we send it to the relevant practice committee. The practice committee organises some volunteers to undertake the work. And then Rebecca, Rick and myself, one of us will work with those volunteers to make sure that our submission, that what the work we're actually doing is clearly presented, makes some key points where there are recommendations, they're highlighted, and is in line with work we've done in the past along on those subjects. So we really need to do a bit of work to make sure that those points are made clearly and are going to have impact. Then what's generally happened is the submission's always only ready a day or two beforehand and we're madly trying to get it out. We have a public policy committee that we then... So the practice committee will sign it off and then we send it through to the public policy committee that Barry chairs and they will approve it and then off it goes. Now, a lot of people have said to me, why don't I get a say in how we do our public policy? So what we're trying to do is actually bring some of those timetables a little earlier to give us a chance to get stuff out to the broader membership for consultation. But I must admit, we haven't been terribly good at doing that so far. We do have a list of issues that we're working on at any time now on the website. So any of you that want to get involved and give your views, I'd really encourage you to engage. So I know the practice committees would be very keen to hear views from our broader membership, but it is something we're looking at. Okay, so that's the way we've always done things. So we sort of react when we're asked, we give opinions. What we've done just more recently is we have started to change our approach there. And the other thing in the past we've done is we've put the submission in and it stops there. And anyone who's worked in policy will know the submission is the tip of the iceberg. It's the bit above the water. Then you've got all the work you've got to do to actually sell your ideas, to actually get them implemented. But what we've got now is we've looked at having a more proactive approach to public policy. And we've developed some draft policies in four key areas. And those, you might have seen are up on the website for your comment. The four areas we've identified, and the guys are going to talk about two or three of them today, retirement incomes, risk management, health financing, and energy and environment. So what we've done there is we've, through the relevant practice committees, we've put together some policies that let us, if something is being asked on this or if something happens or if we want to actually get out there on the front foot and say something and make an impact, this gives us some agreed positions that we can go to. So it lets us do two things. One, if something happens and we're asked for an opinion, we can get something out very quickly because we've already agreed the policy. Secondly, excuse me, it lets us really display leadership. And I'll talk just in a moment a bit more about leadership. But those of you who were at the first plenary session this morning, Simon Longstaff spoke about the tiger in the room being the thing that is the strategic risk that no one's recognised that slowly clamps its jaws around your neck. I actually believe, and if you look at the presidential addresses over the last few years, you'll see that our profession is facing a number of these tigers. And our proactive policy effort, I believe, is a key weapon in our arsenal that we're going to need to fight those strategic challenges. And it's also a way that we can show leadership. Also something Simon Longstaff mentioned this morning, the importance of leadership and the dearth of leadership that he's seeing in corporate Australia. So I think it's beholden on us as a profession, who are a disinterested party, who are really looking at things from the public's interest, to step up and fill that gap to the extent there is one. It's also something that Peter just mentioned in his talk just now, the importance of these leadership positions. And we as a profession really can make sure that to the extent we can influence public policy to good outcomes for the average Australian person, then I really believe that we should be stepping up and doing that. Thank you.
Okay, so they're the introductory comments. When we look at the, we'll go through some of the actual policies now. And the policies sit in, they're considerably categorised into three or four broad groups. The first group is where we've got policy. So where we've actually developed something, got some ideas, and we've got agreement, broad agreement from the membership, and we've promoted that idea. And that's very much in the retirement income space, where we've very clear views about what we think is the right way to go forward. The other area is in is where we don't have a policy at all, and in fact we're hardly ever likely to get a policy, but we've got very important things to say. So, for example, in the flood question, there's some very ideological questions around should it be national insurance versus should it be private, and I'm not sure as if we're ever going to get a consensus from our membership about that, but we certainly should be in there helping make policy because we've got things to say, we've got perspectives and technical skills. And the third broad area is where we should have a lot to say, like in the national disability situation. So this is a major reform that's happening around Australia. There's a proposal for a national disability scheme. We've got actuaries all over the place involved with local state schemes. So we should be all over that stuff. But the problem is we haven't got the resources physically to do it. We've had two or three people bravely put some submissions into the Productivity Commission. But basically that they've run out of energy. And so whilst we've got lots to say, we've got nobody to say it. And so we're basically saying we can't do any more in that area. So they're the sort of three broad groupings. I might ask Andrew Bowell, chair of who's worked with the group developing the retirement incomes policy, to take us through what our policy is and some of the issues you had in developing that and how you got consensus.
Okay, before I go on to the incomes policy itself, Melinda talked about the reactive and the proactive part of policy. From the Superannuation Practice Committee perspective, in the last 3 years, we've reacted to a lot of and put submissions into the government regulators and to departments. We've lodged 36 submissions in the last 3 years, so on average one a month. So the reactive part of the policy area is a very busy thing. In the proactive area, looking at the way the practice committee works, we broke our area down into three or four main topics that we wanted to focus on. So we're looking at the areas in superannuation that were big issues for the industry, and so we focused on risk, and we put two together really, which were around efficiency and disclosure. and the last one being adequacy and retirement incomes. And so if we look at how we go about the proactive part of the debate, we talked a bit before about we have task forces and working groups who work behind the scenes, so I'd like to thank all the volunteers on those committees as well, who actually develop a lot of the work initially. That then comes to the SEBPC for review, and so there's an internal review and checking process that goes on there. Sometimes that involves going back and having some toing and froing and some discussion to make sure that we're in agreement about the way forward in those particular areas. And then, of course, it used to go to the Executive Committee, now it's to the Public Policy Council Committee, if I got that right, and that Barry chairs, and make sure that they're being consistent with other parts of the policy across the whole institute, and not just something just focused on superannuation, but also we're not saying something that's different to the life insurance or general insurance areas. And an important part we haven't spoken about is also then the communications part. And that's the area where things go up on the website so that people can view them and participate by reviewing drafts at different stages and comment on it, come back to the practice committee with comments or ideas, but also to run super policy forums or financial service forums or papers at conventions like this week. So if we first of all look at the risk area, one of the areas we've been working on there is around reserves and superannuation risk management. And we ended up doing... running a session on this at the Financial Services Forum in 2010, and Darren ran another session here today on that area. So there's work continually going on in those areas. On efficiency and disclosure, that's talking a lot about fee disclosure to superannuation members and reporting that to members. It also therefore covers off transparency and making sure that members understand how the fees are made up, how it's reported to members, and projections to retirement are also an important part of that area. And the Benefits Projections Working Group does an awful lot of work in both of those areas, on behalf of the SEBPC. We had a Financial Services Forum session in May 2010 on one of those issues there, and also ran a Super Policy Forum on that in October 2010 as well. We finally turn to the question about adequacy and retirement incomes. The Retirement Incomes Task Force started work on this many years ago and culminated in a paper being released in August 2008. And I think that was published on the Institute website, and there was an opportunity for members to participate in discussion around that paper. And the paper covered off a number of areas which have ended up going into the policy document that's now on the website. But once that document was released, we then ran a super policy forum in November 2009 that discussed all of the issues that were released as part of that paper, went through a lot of the detail and gave members an opportunity to ask questions about the issues raised in the draft paper. And I think later this year, it's such an important topic that we'll be running another super policy forum later this year to discuss more detail around how some of those ideas work in practice and a bit more of the detail. So in turning to the actual retirement incomes policy itself, there were four main areas that we covered off in it. The first part was just a comment on the superannuation guarantee. I don't think you can have a retirement incomes policy without covering off the superannuation guarantee level. It's an area that's been debated a lot by the industry over the years and within the profession as well. And I think everyone will accept that there is no one number that is right for every person in Australia. The way the age pension system works and the interaction through means testing works and people's own different retirement ages and different requirements and spending requirements in retirement means that there is no one number. And so the role of a compulsory system versus a voluntary component to superannuation savings was always a part that was debated very readily during the industry and also by the Institute. In the end, we've come up to a position where we supported the increase from 9% to 12% for the superannuation guarantee, but we did acknowledge that for some low-income earners in particular, that there could be some negative outcomes as a result of that, where their incomes prior to retirement will be detrimentally affected, and they'd actually end up having replacement rates above 100%. And that one of the ideas for government might be that in order to compensate the lower income earners, where that wasn't a great outcome, that the low income rebate for people earning less than $37,000 a year might be able to be taken in cash rather than as a superannuation contribution to alleviate the poverty before retirement, rather than just giving them a much even higher replacement rate in the post-retirement period. The three other parts of the policy itself then turned to, it linked into other government policies. So one of the government initiatives was looking about helping people to work, stay in the workforce longer and work past age 65 when they can. And so a few of the issues there related to the deferred age pension. And so the idea in the paper and in the policy position was to reward people fairly for continuing to work beyond age pension age. So at the moment there is some reward, although it isn't a fair compensation for the amount of age pension they're giving up to continue working. And so that's the first part of the retirement incomes policy, is around rewarding people fairly at neutral cost to government is the desire, so that people are encouraged to work longer where they can and therefore not start drawing on their savings earlier than they really need to. Hand in hand with that part of the policy is adjustments that are needed to be made to the means tests to make that work, and that's a very complicated part of the process, which is what we probably need to talk about a bit again later this year at the Super Policy Forum. But also the means test is very complex for particularly people as they get older, and having to complete information and forms around your income when you're 93 years of age becomes a bit tedious and a bit difficult for a lot of people. So it's actually making the income tests or the means tests work better for older Australians. And the final part was actually related to longevity risk and the inability of us so far to come up with a longevity solution that adequately meets the needs of retiring Australians from their own superannuation sources. And so to remove the barriers for an annuity market, and particularly a deferred annuity, but to put in place some areas where an annuity market can prosper and thrive, and so that Australians have a choice to purchase an annuity cost effectively to help them fund their own retirement from their own resources.
Thank you, Andrew. Now, we'll come back to some of those, because there have been some pushback from members on a couple of items there, so we'll come back and talk about that in a minute. Peter McCarthy, can you talk particularly about the flood issue? And because John Trowbridge mentioned today that he's had discussions with people from the Institute. I know you've got lots of actuaries actively working away, helping behind the scenes, and we've had a few pieces in the paper as well. Can you talk a bit about what's been happening there and...
In one word, a lot, or two words. I must say, I think the flood issue is really complex issue from a public policy point of view. Where we started off, a few years ago, the Institute had set up a committee on flood. There were three papers that came out of that. Some of them were presented at General Insurance Seminar, I think in 2008, and at the... equivalent of this seminar in 2009. And even before that, a number of actuaries have actually done work around flood insurance. It's been, I guess, an issue around the general insurance industry for decades. The first time I was aware of a paper being written was one by David Hart, I think, in the late 70s or early 80s. But it's an issue that I guess the insurance industry has struggled with over decades. So with all these disasters, floods, cyclones, etc., we actually thought about reconvening the flood committee. So we sent out a note to all interested actuaries. We had, I think, about somewhere between 15 and 20 people who wanted to make a contribution. And as part of that, we had noticed the debate in the media was actually... very narrowly focused. There was a lot in the paper about definition of flood and flood mapping, but that was about it. So we thought that we needed to broaden the debate in the media so people were aware that there was a lot more issues. And I sort of look at it, well, you can have all the definitions of flood you like, but it's not going to deal with the issue. It's not going to deal make insurers actually offer the cover. So we decided to put an opinion piece in the Australian Financial Review, and we did have that was picked up by a few journalists, and we had discussions with them. A few more articles appeared. One interesting thing happened as a result of that article. I received a phone call from a guy called Anthony, and I can't remember the organisation, ASPI, Australian Strategic something or other. Yeah. Policy Institute, and the day of the Fin Review article, he said, "Oh, I've been preparing a paper with a number of other people for the Attorney General on flood insurance. So he sent it to me, and what struck me around that paper is that while it was well written, was it was again fairly narrowly focused. It didn't really identify all the issues around flood. So as a result of that discussion, we then decided, well, it would be probably good from an institute point of view to actually try and sponsor a seminar on flood to, again, get the debate out in the public arena what all the issues are. Now, a lot of people have actually done a whole lot of work, including the institute, in trying to put together the seminar around flood. It is not aimed at just actuaries, but it's actually aimed at, I guess, quite a variety of different organisations, governments, insurers, etc. And I hope that seminar is very successful. The other thing is that we've done is put a submission into the Queensland Inquiry, and now we've got the disaster review. In fact, Rick Shaw and I were down in Canberra the Monday after the John Trowbridge review was announced, and we had, it was a good time we had a discussion with Treasury about that. We also went and had a talk to the Attorney General's Department, and I was initially going, what's the Attorney General's Department got to do with disasters? Didn't quite understand. Well, what we found out when we met with them is that they've actually had a task force or an area of the Attorney General's Department working on resilience around disasters. And the issues are very complex. So now we're at the stage where we need, we put pen to paper with the flood inquiry. We actually met with John Trowbridge, and he's, there was about a cast of thousands at the meeting last week with John Trowbridge. And they seem very interested in the practical experience of some of our members around flood insurance in particular, but more generally disasters. And I should also remind people that with the terrible fires in Victoria a couple of years ago, Daniel Smith actually led a team which put a submission in around those fires. So that's where we are. We don't have a policy around flood or disasters. It's a very complex issue that needs to be dealt with, a lot of interest. And I guess I've actually put the question out there to a few people, a few actuaries, including Barry and Melinda, should the Institute actually develop a policy around disasters? Now, discussing with a number of actuaries, there are really quite mixed views. So the question remains out there, and I'm not sure where we go. I think we have a risk that because there is so much going on around disasters and flood, that we need to be careful we don't develop public policy on the fly. And I found that the timetable we've had to put together some of these papers, etc., has actually been really short, and it's been a real challenge.
Okay, thank you, Peter. And Kent, do you want to talk about probably what has been part of our core policy approach, risk management, and how companies use actuaries and FCRs and all that sort of stuff? So,
yeah, sure. I might start first a little bit with context. So during the course of the last year, the Risk Management Practice Committee made its first foray into putting together a public policy. The context was part of the remit of the committee is to raise, I guess, the profile and the awareness of actuaries in the risk management industry. We've got a range of actuaries either working directly or indirectly in risk, whether they're subject matter experts right through to chief risk officers. And so one of our objectives is to raise that profile. As Peter mentioned, we similarly ran a seminar last year, an enterprise risk management seminar, and we had a good attendance from actuaries and from non-actuaries. But what we actually really wanted was some sort of statement that we could go out with that was succinct and that would possibly capture the attention of people, and that we could use to start to position actuaries a little bit in that sort of leadership role in amongst other professions. So we looked at what we could say. Now, look, for anyone who's actually read our risk management policy on the website, I'm not actually going to ask for a vote who has. I might be a bit worried about the result. But it's not exactly the most earth-shattering policy. The process itself was quite interesting, having the discussion. It was a discussion in the committee that was moving away from actually responding to something else someone had said, or something that was very firmly centred in analysis, to basically taking a position, having an opinion. And it's not something I think as a profession we actually do a lot. Interestingly, at the time, we did a little bit of a look around to other institutes, because, you know, we thought, why reinvent the wheel? There's bound to be some other institutes in the world, that institutes of actuaries in the world that do this sort of thing. And we couldn't actually find similar policies. Now, I'm not sure if that's completely the case, but I think for the most part, this idea of having policy, the list that Melinda's put up, is something that's largely being done in Australia. So we put together a policy. The policy itself makes statements around its aims being to address a better understanding of risks, to basically recognise that companies take risks probably unnecessarily, and certainly there's an opportunity to optimise risks. And then it really goes into three broad areas, and I said I don't think you're going to find any of this really earth-shattering. The first is that ERM tools and disciplines are a form of best practice that companies should use in managing risks. So here we talk about a few different things. The first is actually having a risk management framework, so identifying, qualifying, assessing risks, having the governance, the policies, etc., all the things that you'll hear about in the various sessions we've had even over the last couple of days. The second was a point around risk management being about optimising risk rather than avoiding risk. So it's not a risk minimisation exercise, rather it's a risk selection exercise, which risks to be exposed to, and doing that optimisation process. And then third, we raised the prospect of risk appetite. And there's a couple of sessions even at this convention on that topic, but the idea of actually setting objectives around risk and having quite a risk-aware culture in your organisation about what level of risk the organisation wants to take. So that was sort of the first area, ERM tools and disciplines. The second area was we stated it quite generically as a regular or periodic review of the risks and the financial robustness, I think, of the organisation, aka financial condition reports. We've got a number of different industries where obviously actuaries have been using those for many years, and as Andrew mentioned earlier, we've had a session from Darren and the task force on FCRs and super during the course of today, so obviously an area where the profession feels that adds a lot of value. The third one, and interestingly, the only area where we actually got feedback on the policy was we expressed a view that boards should take advice from risk management professionals in this area, and ideally boards would have in their membership or count in their membership risk management professionals, of which actuaries were just one profession that could fill that role. That was the one topical area where we got some response about how many boards there were in financial services and therefore how many actuaries you'd have to have working on boards. So we had a little bit of discussion there. But for the most part, you know, it was a fairly innocuous policy in some senses, but it did serve the purpose of when we're out there talking with people, we have a reasonably brief statement, one or two pages, which we can put forward the foundations as a profession of what we believe about risk management.
Thank you. So I've got this idea, Yolanda, and what my idea is that I reckon, well, we got climate sceptics who are actuaries. I won't ask for a show of hands, but my guess is that there's probably maybe 10%, 20%, but certainly a minority of actuaries are climate sceptics, and bugger them because I'm not, so I don't care. So what I think we should do is we should actually get a headline out there, and the headline says, if we don't bring a carbon tax in and the world doesn't follow, insurance premiums are going to double in the next 10 or 20 years. And that's actually the business case that compensates for the increase in electricity costs and et cetera, et cetera. And we can do the mathematics that show that. If the climate doesn't change, things will get worse. We did just put a submission into Gano showing the sort of increases that we could expect from deteriorating climate change. Is that a good thing for us to do? I mean, why wouldn't we do that?
I think there are a couple of points that you raised there that's important to kind of unpack. The first is what's the appropriate area for you to be commenting on, and the second is what's the appropriate and useful type of media coverage that advances the profession's reputation or not, in fact, can be damaging. And I think so the first point in terms of what's the appropriate area, I mean, you don't want to be all things to all people, and it's probably fair to say that there is a whole other profession out there called climate scientists who are much better placed to be able to comment on whether climate change exists and getting into the whole debate that sceptics or otherwise engage on. So that kind of, you know, if you look at what's the appropriate domain for actuaries, then it's about the impact of climate change and measuring those risks and understanding what the impact of those risks are, and obviously particularly in terms of premiums, which then comes to your second point. You know, if we have a headline that premiums are going to increase by 150% in 10 years' time based on current climate change forecasts, you know, do we go out with a press release with that headline? And Barry brings up this example because this is a very real example that we kind of battled with, but 3 or 4 weeks ago, due to the submission that the actuaries made to the Garno review, which found similar findings. And the view is that sometimes, even though it's a very well-considered actuarial argument, and that, you know, it has some credibility to it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it makes sense to go out and put a big blazing headline out there saying actuaries say premiums are going to rise 150%. I imagine, you know, if there's a fair few of you who are employed by general insurers in this room alone, and I think if your general insurance employers saw that the profession was out there, you know, talking about these issues that are very sensitive to the industry, it would ruffle a few feathers. And so sometimes it's not, you know, getting a headline to ruffle a few feathers or just for headline's sake doesn't make sense. You know, you've got to make sure that you're putting those thoughts out there and putting those ideas out there in a considered and responsible way. So how we handled that exact situation was to unpack some of the ideas that underpinned that 150% premium increase and put it in a very targeted, measured, controlled way through a contributed article that we secured in The Australian, which allowed us to control the message entirely because we had almost 100% editorial control, rather than a press release that could have been picked up broadly and widely and sensationally to no great benefit.
So while I've got you, social media, can we use social media to develop policy?
Look, social media in Australia is still very much in its infancy compared to international markets, and the US and the UK are examples of where it's been taken off much more quickly and much more established than it is here. It is still, you know, in all markets, but particularly in Australia, it's very much a consumer mechanism and still pretty much the domain of consumer brands to help get, you know, talkability out there for their products. Or it's an activist type of tool. So, you know, GetUp is a classic example of a really great social media concept and that uses other social media platforms really effectively to get and galvanise public interest around public issues. And if you look at where the Institute is currently engaged from a policy perspective, it is very much industry-led. It's still very much industry issues that have public relevance, but the area that you're contributing to is still at that industry or government policy level. And so social media really still isn't a tool that is influencing that sphere. And the traditional mechanisms of consultation through the halls of Canberra or otherwise, submissions, mainstream media, and other kind of industry dialogue is still really the main way to be influencing that debate, which isn't to say that's going to change. I think the beauty of social media is that no one's an expert, and what's happening yesterday won't be what's happening tomorrow. And, you know, in 5 years' time, this whole conference could be run via Facebook and Twitter. Who knows?
Okay, thank you. Peter Broadhead, I've got a... if you go through our policies on insurance, you'll find some major anomalies. And one of the most important ones is that in general insurance, we promote risk rating. So we think risk rating is very important. But our health policy is actually supporting lifetime health cover for health insurance. I mean, does that make us look stupid when you see inconsistencies like that, or are we just being pragmatic?
Where to start? So, again, emphasise I'm speaking as me rather than my department or government. Community ratings are an historical artefact. It becomes from the days when the policy for having some form of health cover in Australia was to have private insurance, so it predates the government's universal scheme. And at the time that the government's universal scheme came in, nobody thought to change the policy in relation to private insurance, so we still have a form of community rating, although it's now related to the age at entry, if you like, so it, the later you enter, the higher it is. But this was because people don't believe that people who are at greater risk of illness ought to pay more, because it's, the view was taken at the time, and I'm generalising grossly here, but that you know, that people's health was not necessarily of their own making. There has, in more recent times, been a lot of debates about that in relation to things like tobacco and so on, but as a general rule, people don't believe that people willfully get ill, and therefore if they get ill it's unfortunate, and therefore, you know, the risk is not something they've voluntarily taken on, and therefore the cost of meeting the treatment for that illness is something that should be spread across the community. That having been said, the risk rating, the lifetime health cover is a policy that was designed to encourage people into private insurance, but in a very sort of graduated way. I believe, from memory, that it was Towers Watson's predecessor that was particularly involved in designing some of the parameters.
Trowbridge.
It was Trowbridge, wasn't it? Sorry, there you go. I knew it was one or t'other, but I couldn't remember which. And I'm not sure, and I probably shouldn't say this, whether their advice was entirely followed. There might be somebody here who knows more about that than I. So the gradient on the slope, for example, I'm not sure whether that turned out where the actuaries might have liked it. So again, it's one of those examples of the combination of technical and political. The reason why nobody wants to touch community rating in a general sense now is because in the end, the people who most use health insurance are the elderly.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at your lifetime, unfortunately, if you look at your lifetime risk of being ill, it bottoms out at about 14, I think. So all of us, I presume, are older than 14, so we're all sliding down the slope at the moment. But this means that if you take a policy of removing some form of community rating, whether it's age at entry or age or moving to just straight out risk rating, you end up basically jacking premiums up monstrously for the elderly, and that's a very, very difficult decision for any government to make. So the opportunity to do it passed, and it's unlikely to be touched any time soon, would be my view, but obviously speaking as myself.
Thank you. Melinda, how do we measure the success of public policy? Have we ever had any success?
Well, it's very difficult to measure success in public policy because the issues you're looking at can go for years and years and years. And I saw, I looked, I know I shouldn't have looked, but I saw another question come up there is, you know, why why bother getting involved in issues when the government may only adopt, like with the Henry Tax Review, a small handful of the whole range of recommendations. And things like tax reform is a classic example of very long-range issues. So I think, I don't know this for a fact, but I've been told that the GST was recommended in a paper, like a white paper or a green paper, years ago, and it was not adopted for another 20 years. So sometimes ideas have to wait a long time for their moment of political opportunity to get adopted. So it can be very difficult to measure. We're just looking at how we do that right now, and it's something that Rebecca's helping us try and formulate. What we used to do at ASIL is we'd have a sort of a win, lose and draw type thing, and things can be draws for a long time until you know really whether the idea got through or not. But it is hard to measure, but I think we should be measuring it, and we're certainly looking at doing that. I think, you know, back to Andrew's point about the amount of work that's been done by some of our practice committees, and we've had very good success rate on a lot of those submissions around technical points. So I think we're much more wins than losses on those ones.
Yeah.
I think when we're getting into these more proactive areas, they're much more difficult to influence policy on.
I mean, would it be fair to say that we were the only submission to the Henry Review to increase the retirement age to 67? And that got up. So is that a good win for us? We're going to broadcast that.
At least our pensioners didn't riot in the streets.
That's right, yes. Andrew, it was interesting the comment that Yolanda made about we've got to stick to our area of expertise. I mean, you could argue that the 9% to 12% recommendation or suggestion from us is actually an economic question rather than an actuarial question. So, I mean, there are a lot of economists that are saying, Liberal Party are saying, in fact, that not, that's, it's more efficient that money stay in the economy than it is being put into super funds. And you could argue that it's in the interests of the superannuation actuaries that that money goes into super funds. So where do we differentiate between what is industry policy and what is professional actuarial policy?
You know, it's a good point about so it's a good point about whether it's a policy that supports members of the Institute. I mean, a lot of the money is going into accumulation form benefits.
So
until we get financial condition reports up in superannuation, there's not a direct correlation with that. I think actuaries obviously provide... have worked in the superannuation area for a long time and have a lot of history and a lot of experience. And so, and with the projections that a lot of the member firms and individuals working in superannuation have done over the years, to be able to say, well, if you're just looking at superannuation in isolation and looking at retirement incomes in isolation, we can make recommendations framed that way, that we're not saying that this is a better public policy outcome compared to somebody going down and spending that money in the shop tomorrow and keeping GDP growth going for the next 2 or 3 years instead. It's not trying to do this or that in policy. It's if we decide that we're looking for adequate savings for retirement in isolation, this is the number that we think is needed. And over the years, that our response to that has changed, probably through a better understanding of how behavioural science impacts on people's decision-making, but also having observed it for a bit longer, that people just aren't making the decisions for themselves. I think many of the members of the committees and the Institute itself probably felt that members could be encouraged and educated to be to voluntarily contribute and make this decision themselves. As it turns out, that's less likely to be the case, and so a mandatory approach is now the pragmatic solution to actually encourage the vast majority of the population to be more likely to have an adequate level of savings in retirement. It's up to the government then to decide whether adequate savings in retirement is an issue that they want to pursue. But if that's one of the issues they want to pursue, then we think 12 is a better number than 9.
Yeah. And while I've got you then, some of the pushback we've had on our retirement incomes policy is the deferred age pension question. So what some people would say is, I think we've said that after 10 years it doubles. So basically if you don't retire at 65 and you just work and then you draw the pension at 75, you'll get twice as much as you would have done if you'd have retired at 65. So that's quite a big up. And what some people are saying is that's encouraging people to spend all their assets in that first year. And then the longevity risk is 100% on the government, with a much fatter tail than it would have been if that have worked through. So why are we recommending that for the long-term stability of provision?
Yeah, and I think hopefully Cathy Nance is in the audience. We're not going to go into the detail of how it's designed, and I think that's an opportunity later this year to have another super policy forum to go through a bit more of the detail around it. But the intention is to make the increase in the age pension fairly reward the individual and not overcompensate them to the detriment of government. You do have to take into account improving longevity and trends in that area, and to that extent, when you fairly compensate an individual for deferring retirement for up to 10 years, that might mean if the fair outcome is to double the pension after 10 years deferral, you might give them 190% or 195% to provide for some contingencies. But the intention was to adjust the means testing and to make sure that the outcome was financially neutral for government. Now, it's a very complex system to actually get that in place and avoid opportunities for people to game the system. I think what we've seen in practice as well is that people with lower savings balances in going into retirement, there's anecdotal discussions going on that people just spend the money and then just live off the age pension. And that might happen to agree, but when you actually talk to people who've retired, they tend to be sitting on the money and not spending it at all.
Yeah.
And they tend to underspend and live below a lifestyle that they could achieve just because they're too damn scared to spend any of the money at all. Mm. And they want to keep it there just in case.
Mm.
And that's the case with my own parents, that they just live a lower, less standard living than they otherwise should and could.
Yeah.
And so in practical terms, that's probably not the issue, but I think we can go through the technical detail at a session later on this year about how the means tests can work to make sure that we fairly compensate the individual without exposing government to too great a risk.
Yeah. Okay, Peter, this would be a hard one now. So there's an elephant in the room, I reckon, as far as the volunteers we use in our committees. And the elephant is that why are they doing it? Are they... Because what happens is that you now get a press profile, Andrew gets a press profile, you can decide whether you use your employer's name or you can use the Institute's name. But it's actually a way of you building a personal profile, potentially at the expense of, with the benefit of the actuaries. So how do you manage... Well, it's probably an unfair question, but I think this is an important question. I think it's an important question for the actuaries to... Because, I mean, we've got a lot of people put volunteers put time and effort into this. Some of those volunteers get a higher profile than other volunteers. How should the Institute manage that? Should we just rotate our heads more often or what?
Yeah, interesting question.
Because then, of course, you get the conflict of interest question. Is that if you're talking on behalf of the Institute, can you then get a job? Can John Trowbridge give you a job as a consultant? You've got to hand one back and you've got to make a decision on it. So that's what I'm trying to get to, I guess.
You do get conflicts of interest. Having been quite involved in the apparalogic work from John Insurance, but also talking to life actuaries, there has been, in my view, a number of conflicts that people have had on an individual basis. I must admit, I think it's a really hard issue to manage and to deal with. I mean, on a general insurance... Flood's actually a really good example. The Insurance Council has come out with a 10-point plan. Now, my personal view is that I have no problem with their 10-point plan. However, it's not what they say, it's what they don't say and address that's the issue. And I think if you go and have a talk to the Insurance Council and a number of insurers, they are dead against the government being involved in this. When we set up the Flood Committee, it was very clear in my mind and a few other actuaries that we weren't going to necessarily see eye to eye with the insurance industry. My private view is that if the government actually really wants to address some of the issues around floods and other disasters, it will need some sort of government intervention, and the insurance industry will be dead against that. So when we actually set it up, we had to choose a leader of the committee, and I sort of recognised and talked to a few other tricks that we couldn't actually have a leader of that committee who worked for an insurer or reinsurer. I actually did ask one reinsurer actuary to be the leader, and he said no because he thought it would actually end up being a bit of a conflict with the employer. So we end up choosing a consultant to lead that group. Even then there was difficulty because I was aware that in the past on flood, some consultants have actually done work for the Insurance Council. So even though there were some people who were actually would have been really good as leaders of that committee, I thought it was in the best interest of them and the Institute not to have them lead the committee. So the conflicts are there. Even, I mean, Rick Shaw and I went down to Canberra and we spoke to the Attorney General's Department and Treasury. And we came away from the, both of us came away from the Attorney General's Department going, they obviously need a lot of help. I could have gone, yep, okay, I'll go in separately because I work for EY, go and say, Mr. Attorney General's Department, I'd like to help you. Now, I have a conflict in that situation. And I actually did talk to Barry about this, that, you know, given the profile that I've had in around floods and disasters and other people have had, that you may actually get a situation where I may be asked as an employee or partner of EY to do some work, and how should I actually handle that?
And what did I say? I can't remember now.
I think it was basically, if that was to occur, then we will actually then take you away from being a sort of a more of a public face from the Institute's profession.
Yeah, good answer.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, good answer.
Yolanda, and incidentally, I have not approached the Attorney General's Department.
It'll be a big deal. Yolanda, you had something.
Yes, that's right. I agree.
The key principles that Peter's mentioning there... is declaring the conflict and make sure that you're being transparent about that. And I think that the ethics that underpin your profession make that a default position, and you've just highlighted perfectly examples where that happened each step of the way. Work on consensus, and I know that my team, who works really closely with you guys in terms of finessing positions, you know, it is a arduous, time-consuming, and at times tedious, and at times very frustrating trying to reach that consensus, but there is a huge amount of effort that goes to compromise so that there isn't a single voice that's dominating, but rather there's as much of a consensus view as possible without watering down that view. And finally, it's about putting the most competent, experienced person in front of the media who is comfortable talking to the press and you know, is a bit of media talent. So sometimes that can be rotated, but, you know, usually there's somebody who's going to bubble to the top. Yeah. And yes, there's going to be people that develop a profile on the back of that, but it's inevitable, and I, you know, conflicts are declared, so I can't see that it becomes a major issue.
Ken, I might ask you the same question, but I'll ask you the question about another elephant in the room, and you can answer both questions. The other elephant in the room is what I call enthusiastic amateurs who are volunteers. So part of the reality is, I mean, volunteers are great, but part of the reason we had the Public Policy Committee was we were getting some crazy stuff coming through from some of these committees, none of yours, of course. And so we had to have a filter, because there are people either with specific strong ideologies one way or the other who are coming up with really crazy ideas, or there are people who are just young and experienced and just sort of misstepping. So the question to you is this conflict about your personal profile, and the other question about how do you... You'd be on enough committees around the place now to know how to manage the enthusiastic amateur.
Okay. all right, let me start with the one that the first question on the conflict. Look, I think I agree with everything Peter said, and so it does have to be managed. I think the other side of it, though, is there is a very positive element to having a strong profession, as we have here in Australia with the Institute of Actuaries. It was mentioned in the session this morning that, you know, the benefit of having a profession. And on the one hand, that puts some constraints around us and the way we operate. But it lets, to the extent we have these issues, and they may present sometimes conflicts with our employers or other sorts of conflicts, to have an alternative way to bring those to the fore, have them discussed and developed through the Institute, I think it's a very powerful thing, and I don't think we should underestimate that. In terms of the enthusiasm of volunteers, look, the only thing I can think to say to that is we have the process that Melinda outlined, and frankly, I haven't really seen policy on the fly. We may do some submissions fairly quickly or whatever, but certainly by the time you go through the discussions within the subcommittees and then within the committees, and then you go to the Public Policy Committee, and then you go to council, and then sometimes you come back to council, and that's not including any socialisation that may actually happen more broadly in the profession. I don't think you could accuse us of actually sort of putting out ill-thought positions. Whether or not they're positions we all agree on, separate issue, and you're always going to get that within a profession. But frankly, I think, you know, what I've seen of the process within the Institute, there's generally a fair number of people who've scrutinised things which filters that out. If anything, I prefer the enthusiasm. I think, you know, we might have some enthusiastic individuals and we might come up with a bunch of things from time to time that in the end we discard, but out of that same enthusiasm comes a lot of great ideas that we can work with and mould into something. So yeah. I certainly don't want to kill the enthusiasm.
Yeah, okay. Andrew, I can ask you another question as well before you...
Just on that one, what you said there is really good, because, I mean, we've got a couple of people on... in the retirement area who are working on stronger super committees at the moment, and I'm just, you know, always surprised, and I shouldn't be surprised, but just how well people who work for competitive firms cooperate with each other when it's really important, and the integrity of the profession's at stake, and that where potential conflicts with, you know, for their firm is recognised in a policy debate that's going through a stronger super initiative, and making sure that they run that past other people from on the committees and from other firms to make sure that their opinions aren't being tainted by their own firm's position or product offering or whatever else is going on. So I think that this profession has been excellent for my dealing with it in recognising those issues and socialising those debates to make sure that we're representing the industry in these forums rather than a particular firm. Yeah.
So a question for you then is do we get situations where we actually risk providing actuarial advice rather than policy advice? So, I mean, do we get asked questions on the committee where it's actually they should be buying our membership? They should be buying consulting from a member rather than asking the Institute of Actuaries for actuarial advice because we're not really set up for that.
And nor do we want to be set up for that. And I think it's, you know, we are a profession that supports people who do this to make money at the end of the day. I mean, we're a profession because we work in business and it's our job. So it was actually a couple of weeks ago I was called by someone from the Institute on a Saturday afternoon that an urgent submission had come through. I won't say where it came from and what it was particularly about, but they were seeking a submission directly from the Institute. And it was work that anyone on the committee, their firms, could have done a paid job to do. And it was certainly, and I expressed that view back to the person, this is certainly not an area where I think the Institute would want to get involved in doing, this is advice. The Institute shouldn't give advice. The member firms give advice, and all the individuals in the Institute give advice. And this is not they were seeking advice on a particular topic that was, they were trying to dress it up as a submission. And it was inappropriate.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to be good at recognising that as well.
Yeah. Now, there's a question down here, which I had to look at twice. I can't quite read it. But it says, how can you support compulsory contributions but not compulsory immunisation? But is that immunisation or annuitisation? Annuitisation, right.
Who's that addressed to? Is that for you, Kent?
So...
Next question.
The same thing. Okay, so how can we say if we're all for compulsory super, why aren't we for compulsory annuitisation?
Well, we haven't come to a final view on that, I guess, and it hasn't been one that's been widely socialised or discussed enough to have a particular view on it yet. I mean, the UK has had compulsory annuitisation since 1976, and when compulsory annuitisation was introduced in the UK back then, the level of annuity that you could purchase with $100,000, I think for £100,000 you could buy an annuity that would provide an income for the remainder of your life of between £10,000 and £14,000 a year. Because of improving longevity and decreasing interest rates over that period of time since then, that same amount of money now buys you a pension of £5,000 to £6,000 a year. And so there's actually a huge revolt going on in the UK about compulsory annuitisation right now because they're not perceiving to get value for money. They don't understand what's changed, but understandably there's a lot of political pressure to actually remove compulsory annuitisation. One other comment I'd make just in the Australian context, or just generally in the global context, when you're spending money in retirement, we talk about a lot about the active, passive and frail stages of retirement, and there are also other events that happen in retirement that are unexpected. And so whilst you might still be in the active part of retirement and spending a certain amount of income each year, you might have a car accident. And you need to replace the car, go to hospital, and do all sorts of other things where there's one-off expenditure. So if you've compulsory annuitised your entire income and you need three times that amount this year because of unexpected loss, what do you do? So there is certainly an argument for retaining flexibility around a significant... I won't define significant today, but a significant portion of your retirement savings. And I've talked a bit at conferences lately about your minimum acceptable standard of living, that you work out, no matter how long you live, what's the lowest standard of living you're willing to accept at any age. And I would be all for people annuitising that part of their income so they never are subject to the risk of falling below that level. But beyond that... And that will be a different amount for each person. So I don't think you can unilaterally say, especially with our age pension system and the means testing system, that 23% is the number that will work for everyone. So, and certainly 100% compulsory annuitisation won't work full stop. So coming up with a policy around compulsory annuitisation is going to be even more difficult than coming up with the savings number to start with. So it's something that will continue to be discussed. And it'll probably take a few years to get some consensus, and I think people's views around that will change as the debate continues too.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, what our policy does say on that is we're talking about removing the roadblocks to product innovation in the annuity space so that some of these newer style products that have aspects of a flaw and some exposure to growth as well during the long periods people are spending retirement can be developed, or can, you know, there's a few out there, but and also removing the roadblocks to people continuing to work and, yeah, and to phase their retirement down, as Bernard Salt was talking about this morning. So, yeah, you know, some of the things we're doing are addressing some of those challenges. Yeah. But,
so tell me this, why is there no actuary demographers like Bernard Salt? I mean, isn't that sort of a natural area?
Barry, shouldn't we be studying philosophy? I think this should be your next career.
It just seems crazy that I don't know of any demographers in Australia who are actuaries, and yet it seems to be a natural core skill of ours, and we should be out there looking at broader than just... We should have a policy around population growth.
There's a question there too.
That's right. That's where I got it from. Thank you.
Keeping you on your toes, Barry.
So we should be building a population models rather than demographers, shouldn't we? A policy around them?
You didn't ask anyone individually.
I think that is an example. And, you know, if you go through the principles that, you know, actuaries bring a certain way of thinking that no other profession does, and that's about mapping out, and obviously you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly as I understand it, it's about mapping out, bringing the future into today. And if there's any area that, you know, that is also relevant to, then it's absolutely, you know, demography is one of them. And I think the other challenge for the profession, and one that we're always looking at, is how do we take, you know, move you beyond the mandate, you know, going to the theme at the conference, you know, so it's not just about insurance or, you know, or retirement incomes or, you know, benefit projections, you know, these, you know, fairly narrow and traditional areas. And I think that's a fantastic example of where, you know, the profession can evolve, and that's perhaps one of the future careers for the up-and-coming actuaries, yeah, you know, of today.
Peter, before you answer, I'll ask you another question as well. What do you see, how do you see we perform, actuaries perform relative to accountants, lawyers in the marketplace of influencing the debate? I mean, do you see us there, or do you see that we better or worse than any of the other professions?
I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer that question. In my own experience, I think actuaries have had more influence than either lawyers or possibly accountants, but that might be an exceptional circumstance.
That's a good answer.
But, you know, if that's one person's experience, it may be completely unrepresentative. And it's also, you know, the area I work in. Perhaps lawyers and accountants are less relevant than actuaries to some of the questions. The thing I wanted to say about the earlier discussion just prior to that is... all questions are value-laden, and what you bring as a profession to a set of questions is particular kinds of technical expertise, understanding and capacity. And it's gratuitous advice, but avoid the ones that are largely about values, because there is no technical expertise in values. You know, that is a political circumstance and so on. So once you start taking positions in things that are largely subject to value judgments, you'll be challenged. Whereas if you can bring an understanding that clearly is yours and, you know, on your skill base, then you can do things that nobody else can do. But every bugger has an opinion on values. And so I would use that as a screen about what you get involved in and how you get involved.
Okay.
If I may suggest, as I said, gratuitous advice.
Yeah, that's fine. That's what you're here for.
Barry, can I just make a comment about your accountant's actuary question, or slightly related? I think one of the things about our profession is we've had a reasonable amount of time where we've had the role of the appointed actuary, which has given us a somewhat unique positioning in a number of industries, not all, a number of industries. And I think this might be a bit of an interesting statement to make, but I think we're starting to see the time where that unique positioning now is declining, and certainly we're working in a lot wider fields than that. That prompts a change in, I think, how we operate. In the past, we haven't really needed to seek out a leadership position in those particular areas because we had the appointed actuary role. Nobody else could do it.
Yeah.
We've talked for 20 years about working in the wider fields. The thing about being in the wider fields, where you can't carve out that unique actuarial role, is you have to in some other way demonstrate leadership. Now, that's not the same as somehow becoming unique in a different area, but you have to be able to carve out a leadership position. And I think, you know, when we're talking about a lot of these things on policy, etc., what we're really talking about is positioning the profession in these different areas to show a degree of a leadership so it can at least participate in the broader discussion amongst other professions and being seen as a contender to operate in those areas.
Yep.
If I may, I'll just offer an observation. How many people here think they're going to end up in residential aged care? Okay, it's interesting. It's a question I've never had a chance to ask a room full of actuaries. My understanding of this, and one of you will no doubt prove me wrong slightly after the discussion, but my understanding is if you make 65 and you're a bloke, you've got a 1 in 3 chance of ending up in residential care, and if you're a woman, you've got a 1 in 2 chance of ending up in residential care. Now, that's a fact I came across when I was working in aged care policy, and they're hugely powerful numbers. And they're obviously put together. I don't think it was actually an actuary who put those numbers together, but that, just those two numbers, for me, as a policy person, made me reassess a whole bunch of judgments about things like insuring against entry to residential aged care, for example. You know, your insurance works best, forgive me for trespassing on your territory, when things are expensive and rare. It works least well when they're almost certain and the cost is known. You know, you can't insure against a certainty. Well, at least not unless you can find somebody stupid enough to give you cover. So, you know, that whole issue of what the nature of the risk is. But it also means that people don't think that. I mean, you know, you guys of all people, there should have been a third of the, at least of the hands in the room up. So that whole issue of how numbers can inform people's thinking about what will happen and what, I mean, one of the conundrums of your profession is that it won't happen to me. Why do we have compulsory superannuation? Because it won't happen to me. So there's a whole set of issues in there about how you get people to think differently about what will happen to them. And that might be one of your jobs.
Can I do a quick time check? Are we supposed to be finishing now or another hour? Is it now, is it? Okay. Sorry, Peter. Listen, it's 1 minute. Is it a 1 minute profound comment or...?
Yeah, it's quick.
Pressure's on.
I was just going to make a comment around the appointed actuary role in that... In the insurance industry, I guess one of the things it does bring, it brings a perspective over the whole organisation and what the issues are, you know, covering risk management. The thing that strikes me about the flood issue and where I think the profession can take a leadership role is that you've got all these different organisations like engineers, and they have a certain perspective on, you know, dams and et cetera. So at the flood seminar, we've got a guy who's supposed to be the guru in dams and risk management. But what I think is going to be the case is that you've got all these little spots of expertise, but there's actually no one really that can bring or put all the dots together.
Yeah.
And I think where we can take a leadership role is trying to put some of these dots together to paint the whole picture.
Yeah. Thank you. That's good. Okay, now, would you like to thank Yolanda, Peter, Melinda, Andrew, Peter and Kent? Thank you. Okay, that's a wrap for today. I've got a few housekeeping notes, so don't run away quite yet. There's a session 8E cancelled tomorrow, an optimisation perspective on clustering with applications to premium rating. 7F, which was cancelled, is now back on again. And there's a mini-program error where session 7E should be Alan Greenfield and Martin Fry, not James Hickey. Don't forget to fill up your feedback forms. Interesting to see what your feedback is for this session. The golfers who have received golfing packs, they're going to pick them up from the IJ stand if they haven't already done so. A note about dinner tonight, and I should say, contrary to what I said about behaving myself yesterday morning, I'm actually being measured up. I've been measured up for a costume for tonight. I've got no idea what it is other than the fact they needed my inside leg measurement.
Scary,
that's right. Now, with dinner tonight, there's 50 staff over there working at the town hall. It's a five-minute walk. You can go across the road into the QVB building and then just walk up to Town Hill there. So these 50 people have us arriving at 7 o'clock on their run sheets. So don't get there early because you'll be standing outside because they won't have opened the door yet. So just letting you know that get there at 7 or just after. And there'll be an escorted walk leaving here at 6:55 from the foyer. I think that's everything, and I hope you enjoyed that, and we'll see you tonight and tomorrow morning. Thank you.